Today on the 21st Show, we begin a series of conversations on existential risks to humankind, such as nuclear war, global warming, artificial intelligence, and pandemics. Those dangers are regularly explored by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which was founded 80 years ago in Chicago. We'll talk with the magazine's editor, John Mecklen. We also want to hear from you at 800-222-9455. How much do you think about these risks? Does that thinking affect your life? And how do you make sense of threats that seem too big to grasp? Again, 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. 80 years ago, a group of scientists gathered in Chicago to issue a warning. These people had just helped build the most destructive weapon in human history, the atomic bomb, and they were worried about what they had wrought. So on December 10, 1945, these Manhattan Project veterans at the University of Chicago published the first issue of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Their goal was to warn the public and policymakers about the dangers of nuclear weapons and to advocate for international control of atomic energy before it was too late. A couple years later, the bulletin introduced what would become its most enduring symbol, the Doomsday Clock. That clock now stands at 89 seconds to midnight, a warning that we are closer to catastrophe than we have ever been. And the threats the bulletin tracks have expanded beyond nuclear weapons and now include global warming, pandemic disease, and artificial intelligence, among others. But in an era when there's great distrust in expertise and institutions, how do these warnings land? And how can we will ourselves to care about these concerns that seem so far beyond the ability of everyday people to address? The writer Christopher Hitchens once observed that we are, in effect, all wearing military uniforms and sitting in an exposed trench. We exist at the whim of people whose power does not derive from our consent and who regard us as expendable, he says. And a normal life, he wrote, consists in living as if this most salient of facts was not a fact at all. Well, today we are trying to do something about that, and we're beginning a series of conversations about these existential risks and why it's so difficult to get people to think about them. My guest is John Mecklen. He's the editor-in-chief at The Bulletin. John, welcome to the show.
Hi, Brian. Glad to be here.
Listeners, you can join us today at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, can we go back in time a little bit, and since it is the 80th anniversary of the Bulletin, talk about the state of mind of those Manhattan Project scientists when they founded the Bulletin, December 1945?
Well, this was, what, 3-4 months after the atomic bombs had been used in Japan, and there were a number of Manhattan Project scientists and leaders even who were pretty clear in their minds that what atomic weapons were was brand new and outside the understanding of world leaders. They didn't really understand what would happen if you didn't control this new power in some way. And the initial thoughts were all about putting nuclear weapons and nuclear energy under some sort of international control. And to push that idea and just generally put out information about nuclear power, they founded the Bulletin. At first, it was either a 6 or 8 page sort of mimeographed pamphlet. And a lot of that was just the reports and proceedings from various meetings and whatever. And the Bulletin became sort of a full-fledged magazine a couple of years later in 1947.
And how does the Doomsday Clock come about?
Well, when they decided that this pamphlet that they'd initially put out was not reaching enough people, was not professional enough, they decided to create a magazine because You think back then, magazines were the big thing, right? Time and Life and whatever. And so they were going to make it a real magazine, and they needed a cover. And one of the engineers had a wife who was an artist named Martia Langsdorff, and they asked her to come up with a cover for the magazine. And she came up with this idea of a clock ticking towards midnight. And they used that as the cover of the magazine, just with a different background color for a couple of years. Martial set the doomsday clock, and it wasn't called the doomsday clock at first, at 7 minutes till midnight, because in her words, that looked good. You know, it looked good to her artistic eye. And it wasn't
visually appealing, right? It's kind of a 45-degree angle there, or maybe 40-degree angle, depending on how you look at it. Yeah.
Yeah, it just looked nice to her eye. And it wasn't conceived to move at first. And then in 1949, I believe, if my memory serves, the Soviet Union tested its first atomic weapons, and the editor of the bulletin, Eugene Rabinowitz, just on his own decided that created a danger, that he just said, oh, I'm going to move the hands of the clock, and he moved the hands of the clock toward midnight. And that sort of started a process where very intermittently, for the next 20, 30 years, the doomsday clock moved depending on world events. It didn't move every year. Sometimes it didn't move for several years. It has moved toward midnight and away from midnight. Up to 1973, that founding editor, Rabinowitz, himself set the time. Since then, they've created different boards of the bulletin have set the time on the doomsday clock. Right now, our Science and Security Board, which is a group of 15 to 20 subject area experts in existential risks, they meet several times during the year and decide in November where they want to set the clock for the coming January. So this January 27th, they will announce the time on the clock.
So you mentioned it's moved closer, it's moved farther away. My understanding is presently at the 89 seconds is as close as it's ever been. What does that represent?
That represents the judgment of these experts looking at, compared to last year and compared to the whole history since 1945, how dangerous is the world? How, you know, not really likely, but, you know, what's the probability of some sort of catastrophe, something that would either end civilization or so seriously impact it that nobody would really want to live in the world after that? And it's just their collective judgment on really whether that danger, the danger of a civilization level catastrophe, is greater or less great than a year ago and compared to history.
Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. If you're just joining us, we are talking about existential risks, and we are doing that with the editor-in-chief of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, John Mechlin. We asked listeners what you think about this through our texting group, and you can join that, by the way, by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Some of the questions we had: how do you think about these risks? Does it affect your life? And how do you make sense of threats that seem too big to grasp? Adrienne in Carbondale said, I think about these things on an almost daily basis, and I have a constant simmering frustration at how it seems like no one else really cares. Certainly no one in power seems to care. I think that people like members of Congress think their wealth will somehow save them and don't really care what happens to the masses. We also heard from John in Elgin, who said, I try to limit the amount of worrying I do about things like this outside my control. I take what practical steps I can through voting, charity, and personal choices. I wish there was more I could do. It seems like past horrors humanity has survived, climate shifts, plagues, major wars, could not have been averted by relatively powerless individuals like me, and I have little faith in the ability of our ruling class to manage the transitions ahead. Thank you to John and Adrienne there. We have other messages we'll share in the future. If you want to join us live today, the number to do that is 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. All right, John Mecklen, the bulletin, it starts out, as we mentioned, it was founded to address nuclear weapons. How did the organization's focus expand over time to include things, as I mentioned, like climate change, pandemics, artificial intelligence?
Yeah, because of the name, people have assumed that, well, it was only about atomic weapons or nuclear weapons. Yeah, but from way back, even into the 40s, early 50s, the scientists who formed the bulletin understood that nuclear technology was just the first technology that would be revealed that could threaten humanity as a whole. And they were talking about other technologies very early on. The bulletin was reporting on climate in the climate change in the 1960s. I mean, I think the first cover story in the bulletin about climate change was in 1978, a long time before it became, you know, a big thing on the public scene. And the same with biological threats. The people at the Bulletin were reporting on them, you know, 20, 30 years ago. So if it was a gradual thing of reporting on all sorts of global kinds of threats. In about 2007, the board decided to formally include climate and shortly thereafter, biosecurity as, you know, things that the Bulletin covered. And now we've added sort of a fourth bucket of terrible things that could come. We just call it disruptive technology. It's new technology that could have, if it's misused, existential dimensions. And the one that people think of when I say things like that, of course, is artificial intelligence. You know, there are obvious ways in which it could do very good things are very terrible things to the society overall. And that's pretty much become the Bulletin's remit, is to deal with technologies that have civilization level potential impacts and to write about how to manage them, how to reduce those threats, and how to, if possible, eliminate some of them.
So, okay, so let's begin with nuclear, as the bulletin did, and go through some of these individual threats. What does the current nuclear landscape look like, right? Can you say how many countries at least roughly have nuclear weapons and what sort of trends the bulletin is tracking?
Well, there are, to everyone's knowledge, 9 nuclear powers, the 3 biggest being the United States, Russia, and China. The United States and Russia having vastly more, even than China, although China is building up its arsenal rapidly as we speak. There are about, if I remember right, 13,000 nuclear weapons in the world. If I've misstated, all you need to do is type nuclear notebook into your browser and pull up the latest or one of the latest nuclear notebooks, and it'll give the exact numbers on how many nuclear weapons each of the 9 nuclear weapons countries has and the total in the world. Right now, the nuclear situation is not good. All 3 nuclear powers are, quote, modernizing their arsenals, meaning they're creating new delivery systems, making the delivery systems more accurate. The United States has just announced it's going to try to build a Golden Dome missile defense structure, which is unlikely to be as effective as portrayed, but it is very likely to be quite expensive and to spark a renewed arms race where other countries build more missiles and more ways to send nuclear weapons to evade the missile defenses that the United States has at least indicated it wants to build.
There's this also, may sound familiar to people who lived through Star Wars, not the movie series, but the political issue in the 1980s, yeah?
Yeah, it is just, it's sort of Star Wars rebooted. You know, the claim is that now the technology is advanced enough to make it practical to shoot down, you know, a barrage of nuclear missiles. I have yet to find the uninterested missile expert who agrees with that. Most that I know think it's a pipe dream and a really expensive pipe dream that will do terrible things to the overall threat landscape. You know, it's also a problem in that all the what had happened through the Cold War was there's an architecture of arms control, a whole set of treaties that have been enacted to control the numbers and types of nuclear weapons. And essentially all of those have fallen apart. The United States and Russia, you know, have essentially withdrawn from all of them, except the last remaining one, New START, which limits warheads and launchers, only it is set to expire in next month, in February. Yeah. And so far there are no talks that I know of, you know, focused on extending it.
Yeah. All right. We are going to continue with John Mechlin, editor of the Bulletin, The Atomic Scientists. We need to take a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.
Support for The 21st Show comes from the Des Moines Arts Center, presenting Manuel Alvarez Bravo, a pioneer of Mexican photography, featuring collaborators like Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera, and more. On view through January 18th. More information at DesMoinesArtsCenter.org.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking with John Mechlin, editor-in-chief of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, about existential risks to humankind and why the doomsday clock now stands closer to midnight than at any point in the 80-year history of the Bulletin. If you want to join us today, the number is 800-222-9455. Are these risks something you think about? How often do you think about it? And how do you make sense of threats that in a lot of ways seem almost too large to really comprehend, or at least to stay, you know, upbeat in your everyday life if you spend too much time dwelling on the possibilities here? We have a text message I want to read now from Terry in Batavia, Illinois, who said, "Global warming and AI concern me more than nuclear war. Now, localized war, Ukraine, Venezuela, etc., are a worry. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know, but I can do something limited about global warming and artificial intelligence in my daily decisions. To quote Helen Keller, I am only one, but I am still one. I cannot do everything, but still I can do something." Again, you can join us today, 800-222-9455. All right, John, we mentioned beyond nuclear weapons, the Bulletin tracks global warming as an existential threat. How would you rate the current state of that risk?
Well, it's a continuing risk. You know, it's something that unless greenhouse gas emissions are leveled off and go down worldwide, the planet will continue to warm. And so far, all the world's countries have done, you know, an absolutely insufficient job of making those kind of cuts in basically requires a gradual getting rid of the burning of fossil fuels as a form of energy, meaning to reach a point where the planet stops warming, you know, it's going to have to be no more gasoline cars, no more coal-fired power plants. We just won't be able to burn fossil fuels. And the problem right now is that one of the leading voices in the world for doing something about climate change, the United States, has completely reversed course under President Trump, who, for whatever reason, doesn't believe the overwhelming consensus of scientists that human activity is causing the planet to warm in a way that could be catastrophic for the planet. The policies that the United States is following, sort of a war on renewable energy in an attempt, even through seizing the president of Venezuela, to expand the use of oil, is extremely counterproductive. It's just flat out dead wrong. And the degree to which politicians who know better aren't making this a front and center issue is, it's kind of disgusting to me. I mean, if you got them aside in private, most Republicans in Congress would acknowledge that climate change is real, it's caused by humans, and that we got to have a plan to zero out the use of fossil fuels in some relatively short period of time. Instead, they've got a president who's going in the exact opposite and wrong direction, and they aren't saying anything about it. So it's not a good situation. That sets an example. Other countries feel they don't have to be as proactive about dealing with emissions. And then there's a whole set of countries that are oil-producing countries that want the money, right? Russia, Saudi Arabia, UAE, you know, the Gulf states in the Middle East, and the United States are all big oil-producing countries. And yeah, on the short term, they can make more money by selling more and more oil and drilling for more oil, but it cannot continue. And the reason for that isn't political. It's a matter of physics. As we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, the planet will warm. If we don't do something about it, the warming will cause true catastrophe. And so I'm sorry I'm so cheery about this, but it's not a good situation.
Well, the whole show is on existential risk, so we're going to just accept this is not a bright, sunny start to the new year. But, you know, I want to come back to something you said, which is if you are of the belief that if you pulled, Republican members of Congress aside, for example, they would, say, yes, we acknowledge this is real. You know, 20, 30 years ago, I think that would have been true. We are so segmented in our information bubbles these days, and you can live in an environment where you only, now maybe should have known is a different thing, but I wonder if people really know, I'm guessing that the bulletin does not have, as wide a subscribership on that side of the aisle as it might among progressive or liberal or democratic people.
You know, that's a common assumption. I mean, I don't think we do, partisan demographics, but it's a very nonpartisan organization, and our experts are most of them truly non-political. And I regularly speak with Republicans, and it's, I understand that people think, because of the way the president speaks, that every Republican in Congress has gotten stupid and forgotten the reality of climate change. I just don't believe that. I mean, it's clear that the climate is changing because of human action, and everything the president says to the contrary is flat wrong. And I don't care if you're a Republican and love the president. You're arguing with physics if you argue that he's correct, because the physics are unchangeable. And as we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, the temperature will go up. And you can see the results already. Bigger storms, bigger hurricanes, longer droughts, extreme weather changed patterns. It's clear that it's happening. It has been studied for more than 100 years. It is not open to question. And so if there are Republicans in Congress who are actually believers that climate change is a natural thing and that it's the climate has always changed and this is just that, you know, they are really stupider than I thought.
You know, on this subject of, you know, what would it take? This is something I think about. What would it take to actually sort of break us out of the partisanship that has taken hold of our responses to so many of these issues these days? And I used to think like, oh, maybe it'd have to be something like a war or a pandemic. Surely a pandemic. We would come together. We would, you know, sort of reaffirm our understanding of science, and it would be something that would be a unifying force in our society. Obviously, that is not how COVID-19 played out. And I know the Bulletin also spends a lot of time on pandemic preparedness, biological safety. Do you think we are better or more better prepared or more vulnerable for the next pandemic?
Well, we keep publishing stories by experts saying we're completely unprepared. We haven't done the things needed. We will almost, it's not almost, the world will certainly face another pandemic, whether it is a more lethal or less lethal pandemic is, you know, sort of a matter of chance, but another worldwide pandemic will happen, and the steps taken to combat it have not been taken. And again, it's the Trump administration has pulled the United States out of the World Health Organization. It's cut a lot of funding for health initiatives all around the world. It's scaled back or, frankly, just dismantled a lot of the U.S. government's public health infrastructure. So we are far less prepared for the next pandemic than we should be. And again, I mean, I don't mean to sound political about this, but you brought up the issue of why is there, you know, a politicization of questions that truly are scientific? You know, global warming is a matter of physics. You know, some of these public health issues really are matters of science. And why are they politicized? And it largely is the leadership of one party has decided it's politically beneficial to it to politicize them. So you'd ask, well, what's it going to take for it to be these issues to be less politicized so that the country can address the issues in some sensible way? And I really just think it needs, you know, leadership in the Republican Party has to become more responsible, less focused on winning just this next election and a little bit at least focused on, well, longer term. We can't have a huge part of our populace hating masks that may be needed if another pandemic happens.
Yeah, I've spent some time thinking about this because we on our program, right? I started this job in March 2020, right? I came in, I was supposed to have a week to get acclimated, but it was like stay-at-home orders coincided with, I think, my second week or first or second. It was the second week of the stay-at-home orders, I think, is when I started. And we just dove right in. And we were very much on the side of, you know, masks, trust the experts, follow the government advice, that sort of thing. And in the last year or so, there's been sort of a public reevaluation, even among people who sort of identify as liberal or progressive, about maybe we shouldn't have been so dismissive of opposing voices at the time. And this is something I really struggle with because You know, I've gotten every vaccine I could during the pandemic. You know, I'm all in on that. I wore a mask, you know, for a couple of years, or at least, you know, following the guidance very, very carefully. My wife's a healthcare worker. And yet, you know, there are people who are saying that, you know what, we in the media had failures in that time. And I wonder how you have thought about that. Do you think that this hand-wringing is warranted, that, you know, somehow the media had a self-inflicted wound in terms of trust? Because, I mean, this is a question that has implications for nuclear risk, climate change, and some of the other threats we've been talking about in trying to communicate those things with people.
I'm a believer in facts and truth, and to the extent that you report something that's wrong and you find out it's wrong, you say, hey, we got it wrong. I'm sorry. You know, this is the right information. But that's not what we're talking about here. Nobody truthfully questions the efficacy of the COVID vaccine or any of the vaccines that are now recommended for children. The only people who question it on phony bases. On, excuse my language, it's bull. It's not based on anything. And so when you say, oh, should the media have, you know, well, no, the media should be full-throated saying this stuff that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is putting out is garbage. He's wrong. He is undermining. He's going to kill people with what they're doing, undermining people's beliefs in vaccines. And I just think that hand-wringing approach of, ooh, maybe we upset some people, is like, it's not the job of the media to make people happy. It's the job to tell them the truth.
One of the other risks we've talked about is, I think you referred to this not as just artificial intelligence, but disruptive technologies. How do you think about that? What, good goodness, what beyond artificial intelligence do we need to be thinking about, right? Bad enough if we're all turned into paperclips or, you know, the machines, as so many movies have shown, decide that humans are an obstacle to optimizing the betterment of the Earth. How are you thinking about those risks?
Well, there are a lot of intersecting risks. So as a, for instance, people talk about AI in the terms you just talked about, it's going to become smarter than us and either kill us all or treat us like pets. But there are other, probably more likely risks or more visible risks in, for instance, AI technology can be used to create new forms of life with gene technology. And there's great worry about using AI to create, for, you know, bad actors to create new pathogens that are very lethal and that there are no defenses to. You know, that's just one example. Another example is the incorporation of AI into weapon systems so that you can create weapons that autonomously seek targets and kill them, blow them up. That kind of technology is rapidly coming into view in Ukraine and elsewhere through drones and other things where having a human actually deciding what is shot at is becoming increasingly less clear and machines increasingly influence what's shot at where and when. And those kind of risks, you know, autonomous weaponry, you know, that those are just two of many, many emerging technologies that...
Sure. All right, we're going to have to take another break, and we will continue with John Mecklen of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. This is the 21st Show. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking with John Mecklen of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists about nuclear weapons, climate change, pandemic disease, artificial intelligence, and what it means to live in an era when the doomsday clock stands at 89 seconds to midnight. And that number could be updated later this month. You can join us today. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. We got at least one message from someone who was critical of the bulletin. Let's listen to a voicemail. This is a man named John who said he used to respect the bulletin. Here's part of what he had to say.
As a person who works in the nuclear industry and who sees the incredible benefits from carbon-free energy and nuclear medicine and huge increases in materials, technologies, they find fear to be the most profitable thing they can do. And so they monger it, they fearmonger, and AI, computing technology, everything that comes down the pike, they have to find a reason to be against it and to spin the worst, most terrible case scenario for everything. It's good to be cautious. It's good to do hazard assessment analysis. But it's not good to make your millions and millions of dollars by scaring the public all the time for everything.
All right. Thank you for that message, John. John Mecklen, what do you think of that? I'm sure it's not the first time you've heard that critique.
Well, it's some of it's pretty humorous. The millions and millions of dollars are a relatively small nonprofit entity supposedly makes by John's comments is kind of absurd, but his critique, I have heard it before. It's not really true. I mean, we've written many, many articles about nuclear power that are positive on its use. We've written a lot of, published a lot of stories that are, you know, point out the dangers of nuclear power as well. And I understand John's critique because I deal so regularly with people in the nuclear power industry who somehow make their living from it. And it's fine that people disagree with what we do. I have no problem with that. But, you know, really and truly, are we, you know, only doom mongers? No, I've run the bulletin for more than 10 years now as a solutions-oriented publication. And the basis of the bulletin, its mission is to talk about the great positive effects that technology can bring, increasing them and reducing the negative sides of technology. You know, these technologies we're talking about are what they call dual-use technologies. They have potentially great positive impacts, like nuclear medicine. I know all sorts of people who have had, including me, who have had great benefits from nuclear medicine. You know, the bulletin doesn't go around saying, oh, you know, nuclear medicine is bad. And it doesn't say nuclear power is universally bad. It's just there are these things you have to watch out for. So I guess my bottom line is that a lot of times for a lot of the people who work in the nuclear industry, nothing you say is positive enough. It's got to be just 1,000% full-throated support of nuclear power in every way, or they think you're the enemy. So
it's interesting because I have a listener who often criticizes me as being too pro-nuclear on the program. So, you know, you can't win, I guess. I want to ask you about this idea of I think it was the philosopher Timothy Morton has that concept, hyper objects, right? Climate change, nuclear arsenals. These are problems that are so vast in scale and duration and potential for destruction that they really defeat our traditional ways of thinking about things. I wonder how that matches your experience trying to communicate about these threats.
There is, I saw right away when I became head editor of the Bulletin that you can either daunt people or make them just tune out because the threat is general. It's a terrible threat, but, a nuclear war didn't happen 2 years ago, so you can point to it and go see how bad it is. So it's somehow theoretical. It's general. Same with climate, although there are some effects you can point to. And so increasingly over time, what I've tried to do is have what we publish address actual solutions and how they might be implemented, realistic ways to make the situation better, and in some ways to directly aim that at ordinary people. There aren't, when you say climate change, well, there are things individuals can do to cut their, climate, their carbon footprint and whatnot. But there are also people sometimes in feeling helpless before these giant, daunting issues, forget that even small groups of people are terrifying to politicians. Just emailing or calling your representatives has real impact. It really does. And getting that across to people that, if you're upset about the climate, if you're upset about the vast amount of money spent on nuclear weapons that really could never be used unless you want to end humanity, tell your congressman, tell your senator, tell your city council people, your state level people, and, be reasonable about it. Just tell them, I'm a voter and I want you to know I'm going to be watching what you do on this issue. And it's effective. I have seen it, and I have talked to enough people in Congress and enough people who have worked with Congress to know that it reaches, it has an effect. It's just so far not enough people are doing that. If you go back to the 1980s, when people were marching in the streets about nuclear weapons, it had a real effect. And we are trying to get more and more people to understand that they have more power than they think.
You mentioned solutions, and I do love that idea of solutions journalism and bringing that together with the timeline you mentioned. If you go to the Bulletin website, you can look at the timeline, and there's a very neat graphic as you scroll through. It shows you every time it changed and how the hands moved. And believe it or not, at some point in my own lifetime, we were, a full quarter hour away from midnight. Things can get better. What are some of the ways you can talk about that, solutions, positive, right? Leave people with hope, right? Some things that have actually worked to reduce our existential risk in recent years, if possible, or if you have to go back a few decades, so be it.
On climate, for instance, there are vast differences between states. I live in California, which has, one of the most, I hate to use the word progressive because everybody gets mad at you if they think you're a progressive, but one of the most progressive and effective programs of dealing with climate change, dealing with carbon emissions that exists not just in America, in the world. You live in another state and you care about that, you can learn about it. And again, talk to your local, regional, and state level officials to see if some of the things, maybe not all of the things, but some of the things that California is doing might be appropriate, might be doable in your state, right? The nuclear issue is a little bit more difficult just because, well, really, when you get down to it, those decisions are made in the executive branch. Congress usually goes along with it.
So really in the Oval Office when it comes down to it, right? Not even just the branch. It's one man.
And so I'm going to be self-serving here, is what the bulletin publishes penetrates the executive branch and Congress. I know this because I talk to the people. You know, I know it because our authors, you know, sometimes want something they've written to be published by a certain date because they're going to talk to the National Security Council that day and they want to give them the article. So on nuclear issues, if you want to have a reasonable voice heard in the government, you can subscribe to the bulletin, support the bulletin. Yeah, I know that's self-serving, but we are, as my boss, Alex Bell, our CEO, says, if the bulletin didn't exist, America would need to create it, would need to invent it. A voice on existential risks is absolutely necessary to dealing with them. And there is no other publication that is solely dedicated to these existential risks. So if you're concerned about them, you know, even if it's, you know, $5, even if it's you just subscribe to our magazine when we put it on sale sometime, you know, however it is, if you support us, we can help.
Last question. What gives you hope in these dark times?
You know, I really do think human beings can manage things they create. It's uneven, but I think that, you know, the arc of history does bend toward justice. You know, I can't imagine that anybody actually wants to destroy the earth. The question is just, how do we make these difficult issues salient enough that enough people decide to do something about them? And I happen to think my job is the best job in journalism. I get to try to save the world every day when I go to work. So to do that, I have to be hopeful. And I really am. I don't think you think of the worst leader in the world, the worst dictator you can imagine. I don't think any of them would have chosen to end civilization, to make the earth unlivable. So if we can get leaders who are a little bit better than that, I believe we can deal with these threats.
John Mecklen, Editor-in-Chief of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us. Happy New Year.
It was my pleasure.
That is it for us today. Coming up tomorrow on the program, it will mark 5 years since the attack on the United States Capitol building on January 6th, 2021. We are going to talk with Laura K. Field, who has written a book examining the intellectual underpinnings of President Trump's MAGA movement. And specifically, she has spent a great deal of time exploring the background and how January 6th came to happen. That's coming up tomorrow on the 21st Show. We'd love to hear from you. Talk at 21stshow.org is our email address. Let us know what you thought about today's show or ideas you have for future topics. Again, talk at 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We will talk with you again tomorrow.